Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon, my weekly podcast where I have lunch with an interesting person with interesting stories from around the world. Last week we were in the USA, but this week we're back home in the UK. My guest is Greg Harris, who is the Global Electrification Services Leader for Horiba Myra. Now, transport people of my generation think of MIRA, the Motor Industry Research Association, as a test track used for the relentless testing of vehicles. It opened in 1946 as a collaborative facility for vehicle testing and based on the site of a former RAF airfield near Nuneaton. It led the way on crash testing with indoor facilities being added in the 1960s. Now, it's much more than that, and I'll let my guest explain. So, hi, Greg. Welcome indeed to Lunch with Leon. Firstly, why don't you tell everybody who you are and what you do?
Hi, I'm Greg Harris. I work for Horiba Myra, engineering and test consultancy in the UK. My job is to develop the strategy around electrification. So this is across both our sort of test and engineering businesses, and that encompasses passenger vehicles, but also the wider automotive space as well. And I get involved in projects all around the world, including the UK, of course.
Sure. So, of course, when I first knew Myra, it was a test track. And I can think back to the 1950s when vehicles were put through their paces. I think we can still see on YouTube lots of grainy black and white videos of vehicles being put through their paces. It was every young boy's dream, at least, to have a go on this test track and do all the things that you can't do on the road. But there's way more to the organisation than that, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the business is over 70 years old. And yeah, it was originally established by the UK government to look at, you know, post-war, to look at the support the UK's automotive industry, and particularly in areas such as vehicle safety. But as you say, over the decades, it's developed, it became a private company. And then in 2015, we were acquired by Horiba. So Horiba is a global manufacturer of test equipment, particularly for liquids and gases. In the automotive industry, they're particularly known for emissions testing. They make most of the PEMS kits that people are using to do emissions testing around the world. But Myra itself has developed its engineering business alongside its test business. So, as you say, it's what people traditionally know Myra for is testing. The test tracks and the wide range of facilities. We've got something like 46 test facilities, different test facilities on site, but also this huge engineering organization that's now equal sort of in terms of revenue, the consultancy business. And that goes right across the whole of automotive engineering.
I can remember the earliest Routemaster buses being put through their paces. But as you say, now, this is not so much now about this sort of testing, it's about the whole range of testing. So you must be pretty busy then with the move to zero emission.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're, as everyone else, this has been a very disruptive year. But obviously what we've seen and, you know, up till sort of 2020 has been this real increase in the number of vehicles that have some level of alternative propulsion. So, you know, either hybrid or full electric passenger vehicles, but also, you know, electric buses and trucks as well. So we've seen increasing requirements to test those, but actually we've also been involved in engineering projects to develop those in-house for customers all around the world. So in those type of projects, we'll work directly with either a manufacturer, say, for example, a bus manufacturer or a truck manufacturer, or perhaps with a tier one manufacturer of some key components such as the electric motors or electric e-axle or something like that. And we'll actually develop the complete system and we'll model it, we'll design it, we'll develop it, and we'll build it into the vehicle and deliver that back to customers.
Okay, so you'll see effectively a sort of advance warning about some of the things that's coming down the track. And I know you can't breach the client confidentiality, but you really are seeing some of the things that are likely to find their way onto motor vehicles coming forward. But the rate of change seems to be so quick now, doesn't it? I mean, there was a time when vehicle development was very stately, but it seems like everybody's got a wriggle on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the other big changes that we're seeing globally, and it's starting to become more prevalent in the UK is this real accelerated approach to development. I mean, you've got companies like obviously Tesla and others making, just cutting a swathe through the traditional engineering approach and really saying, what, why do you have to do it like that? Some people might argue that that's why, Tesla doesn't have the most brilliant of sort of customer ratings in terms of the quality of the vehicles, but in principle, they're saying, we don't need to do it like this. There's a very strong push onto simulation and modeling, so and that's something that we follow as well. A huge amount of simulation modeling right at the beginning of the program, and then sort of system level testing, which helps to validate those simulation models, but also helps to identify any issues at a system level. So rather than the traditional way of, yes, building your vehicles and testing them and finding a problem which you then have to try and resolve once you've already built the vehicle, we're actually able to, identify those issues early on, which reduces cost, reduces overall time, and it really helps with the approach today of now trying to develop so many multiple variants on one platform, which is obviously a big challenge to resources and budget.
Yeah, and the other one that fascinating, I've seen this in particular in rail, funnily enough, for many, many, well, for ever since the beginning of time with rail, we've been able to do life extension work on rail vehicles because they were built structurally so strong that in fact the structure was in good condition 20, 30 years later, and it was possible to extend and extend their lives. And then, of course, came the advent of computers. And the engineering calculations were done very, very scientifically. And somebody somewhere would be asking, how long design life do you want? And somebody would say 25 years. And so now we're finding that when rail vehicles in particular reach their design life expiry, say 25 years, actually the structure's had it. And there's nothing wrong with it, but it was built down to a price and a design life. And so, frankly, now in the case of some rail vehicles, the life extension cost and the new vehicle cost are the same because, of course, of the old structure. So does that happen in automotive as well? Is there now a design life beyond which you really just can't go?
Yeah, I mean, there is some truth in that, I suppose. I mean, in passenger vehicles, it's not really been this huge model for very significant sort of, renovation, fixing things that go wrong to keep vehicles on the road for sure. I mean, there hasn't been a big tradition of a, let's take that chassis and put a new engine in and everything else. That has, I mean, clearly in the bus world, we've, that has been part of the model is to, is that the actual bus chassis and the systems can have a longer life than the engine, and there has been, the approach, particularly as sort of emissions requirements have changed, to update buses with the latest, with later engines, either because those engines are worn out or just to make them be able to achieve the latest emissions targets. And yeah, we see that as a significant opportunity now when we look at electrification. So clearly, there's this huge push to electrify the UK's bus fleet, which is absolutely the right direction. It's very expensive, of course. It's a huge investment, but one of the approaches that we see is to look at the part used life of that of a diesel bus and look to convert that to electric, because typically, let's say 8 to 10 years into the life, the bus may well have some level of refurbishment anyway, but it has a lot of life left. And then if you look at the targets now from the government in terms of moving towards electric bus fleets, the number of buses in the market, and that timescale, it doesn't really add up.
No,
You get to the point where, you're taking perfectly good buses off the road in the UK and either scrapping them or moving them somewhere else, which kind of just moves the problem around, really, doesn't really solve it.
well, you would have done the same numbers that I've done, because even if I assume the bus fleet by 2040 will be smaller than now because of the drift downwards in passenger ridership, and even if I assume that a proportion of the bus fleet will be hydrogen, that's a different conversation for later. There isn't enough time and there isn't enough capacity to build all the electric buses that you need to hit all the deadlines, which are different for different parts of the country and different companies, but a sort of backstop of 2040. So therefore, there's going to have to be some retrofits. some modern diesel or indeed hybrid buses will have to be converted to electric if we're going to hit all the numbers that we need to hit by the time. And I think that's interesting. So then as a question, electrification, which is something that is just moving so quickly now. So it feels to me, and I've heard it said, that we're at a bit of a tipping point now. There is, for the first time, the beginnings of enough volume for electric vehicles, especially with van, light goods vehicles, cars, and buses, that for the first time, the economics are just starting to look a bit more sensible because of the volume. So are you reading that too?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, I think, when you see this kind of change, and although obviously the impact of COVID-19 has been, you know, extremely detrimental to the UK's automotive industry, and obviously, and you know, particularly to public transport as well. In the overall picture, the sort of, you know, some of the positive messages there have been, you know, in September this year was the first year that more battery, electric and hybrid vehicles were sold in the UK than diesel. And who would have predicted that 3 years ago? You know, that's passenger vehicles. So that's an indication of the change. And I think year to date, I think petrol and diesel are down around 50%, but electric's up 150%. So it does seem to be one of the kind of winners out of this situation. And I think, you know, there are a number of reasons for that. The government support, you know, in terms of the investment in infrastructure, supporting that and in supporting people to personally buy vehicles or through company car schemes has been very useful. And a lot of people are taking advantage of that. I think there's still a bit of a, you know, still a question open around buses, because although there's been, you know, very large numbers talked about, originally 5 billion, I think now 3 billion that's specific for a low emissions or zero emissions buses, but the mechanisms about which that are going to be applied are still unclear. You know, the Low CVP recently put together a paper and the bus working group for the government, which looked at this issue of the funding so far has been boom and bust. You know, you get a funding opportunity, you apply for it. If you get it, you build some electric, you buy some electric buses. If you don't, you don't. And then, but there's no clear follow-on path. I think there's, you know, to support the continued growth, we need to see a change in policy, which will actually enable people to plan and to say, okay, we know that these subsidies are going to be in place and we can invest on that basis. So I think you're right. There is a tipping point, but there's quite a few factors that would, you know, take that forward strongly and successfully, or hold us back effectively.
Yeah, there's also a taxation problem, isn't there? Because there is 28 billion worth of fuel duty that has to be replaced, and at the moment, zero emission vehicles, electric vehicles, do very well because they don't pay any tax on road fuel. There are great incentives if you convert from diesel to electric. Not only is electricity cheaper than fuel, it doesn't have tax on it. But that tax is going to have to be replaced, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. I don't see an issue with that. I think the important thing is how you is very carefully managing the subsidy approach. So what we've seen in China, for example, was they, by reacting to the market, you know, reacting to what they were seeing in the marketplace in terms of the uptake of electric vehicles, they withdrew subsidies very quickly, cutting off a large proportion of the market, actually the more economical side of the market, because they demanded a minimum range and a certain fuel efficiency and a number of other factors. But the minimum range has actually killed off the bottom end of the market, you know, the entry level vehicles. And so they've had to, you know, reassess that and look again, and things are picking up again in China. But they can also restrict. So they stop people from buying petrol and diesel vehicles by not allowing them to be registered. So I don't think it'd be a very popular approach in the UK. So they have more tools at hand. But I think the point is that however you do things, you have to manage those subsidies in a way that will sustain the growth. So you could say in places like Norway, they've probably gone too far that in the other direction. They've done a fantastic job in it getting the population to move to electric vehicles. But obviously, you know, there's a detriment to the income side of things. Personally, I see the way forwards will be that they'll continue to increase the levels of taxation on petrol and diesel cars and start to introduce electrification. You know, the taxes on electric vehicles will come up, but there'll always be a delta. as long as that delta is significant enough, it will continue to move people onto electric vehicles. So I think that as long as it's carefully managed and the government doesn't switch off the customers, I think that we've got the opportunity to keep growing.
And you're plugged into the International Brotherhood of Engineers considering the whole electrification business, aren't you?
Yeah, so I mean, as MIRA, we were always had quite a good, strong presence in certain countries such as China and India. We've had, I think we've been in India and China for more than 20 years, and India similarly. So we've always been well connected into those automotive industries. Through the acquisition by Hariba, we now have a strong presence in Japan. It's a great opportunity because it's quite hard to achieve that from a UK company, but also we're connected into the markets in Korea and Europe and the USA. And there's a huge variety of activities going on, as people know, from startups that are innovating and rapidly trying to bring products to market. And, you know, the existing OEMs who have to manage their resources to still keep producing petrol and diesel vehicles, which still make the majority of the profits at the moment, but make sure that they're making their businesses safe for the future. So yeah, it's great that, you know, to have that opportunity to engage with different markets around the world and see how they're dealing with the challenges in a similar way, but also in different ways, depending on the specific markets and customers. So yeah, so one of the other areas that we get strongly involved in is across the industry with conferences and webinars that are going on, and that's actually been booming. I think, you know, in when you don't have to take a day out and get in your car and drive or get on a plane and fly to another country to go to a conference, you know, the opportunity to join webinars and conferences that are being held online gives us an easy link into what's going on around the industry. It's maybe not quite so good for networking, but I think people are increasingly becoming used to that. One of the conferences that I've been involved in for the few years, the International EV Battery Conference that's organised by the IMEC, is coming up in November in a few weeks' time. That will be held online for the first time this year. So I'll be enjoying the challenges of online chairmanship of one of the days of the conference. But I mean, that's a great event. It brings engineers from all over the world to discuss the challenges of making batteries for electric vehicles cost effective and safe, and looks at a lot of the new technologies that are coming through and how those are being developed.
I don't know about you, I continually find people trying to jump straight into the solutions. And I try from time to time, and I had the chance recently, just to remind people that what we're really trying to do is we're trying to take the free energy that comes from the sun and the wind and convert it into traction. And people like to jump halfway into that. But actually, I think it's often good to remind people to think this free energy comes from the sun, it comes from the wind, and we want to make wheels go round. Yeah. For each application, what's the best way to get it there? Because I do find, as I'm sure you do, this VHS and Betamax argument about hydrogen and battery electric. And of course, the VHS and Betamax, as we know, were two competing forms of video recorder, one of which was technically better than the other, but the other was actually more popular. Whilst everybody was busy going bust having this argument, of course, videotape was completely eclipsed by digital and the whole thing fell over. So a bit with hydrogen and electric, I'm finding that people are wedded too early to backing one of those solutions. And I think my view, and I'm going to ask you yours, my view was they will all have their place. But actually, we ought to think more seriously about the whole renewable energy input side before we get too wedded to technology. So where do you see this electric and hydrogen argument going?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you, Liam, that we definitely shouldn't be closed off and too focused. I think there has been a tendency in the UK, particularly the UK government, if we go back 5 years or so, really sort of got their head round battery electric vehicles and hybrids using batteries and huge amount through the APC and the Faraday Challenge, etc., into developing batteries. But more recently, we've seen, you know, an openness to look at fuel cell applications as well. And this is similarly, we've seen the same thing that we were 5 to 8 years ago. We were looking at programs that for either, and then it went very much onto batteries. But more recently, we've seen a lot more interest and opportunity in fuel cell projects. So particularly in long distance and heavy duty applications, it really has some strong benefits, which you, despite, you know, the Tesla truck and things like that, we, you know, most people can agree that carrying around tons and tons of batteries to give you the range that you need to move a heavy duty truck along the motorway isn't a very practical solution. From an efficiency point of view, from a cost point of view, and from a payload point of view, it really doesn't make sense. I think the benefit, I would say, the simple thing, if we draw a graph and we think of range versus, you know, sort of mass of the energy storage system, it's almost linear for a battery. You know, you need, you know, you're continually increasing the mass in almost linear approach. Whereas with hydrogen, you have a base, and then, you know, that goes up much more slowly as you increase the range. You need a bigger tank and more hydrogen. I think there's definitely benefits to that. And we're seeing projects on things like refuse vehicles, buses, particularly, and trucks now, where, you know, customers are increasingly interested in that, particularly for longer range and heavier duty. So there is still opportunity in passenger cars. The problem I see with that is always the infrastructure, because unlike electric vehicles, no one can charge their hydrogen vehicle at home. So you need that widespread infrastructure, which would be very costly to invest in. And it's hard to get to the point where you can get enough that people can be confident to buy vehicles. So in certain areas, in certain countries and places like California, they are putting in the infrastructure levels to make that a more practical, viable route for passenger vehicles. But vehicles with fixed routes and returning to depots and things like that, much more straightforward problem to solve.
Sure. The other one that's perplexing me a bit, there also seems to be a bit of a conflict, because on the one hand, we want to decarbonize our transport as quickly as possible. We especially want the benefits for air quality in urban areas. And to that extent, battery electric is more advanced than hydrogen in terms of its maturity. And yes, So it is possible to make reasonable progress. But on the other hand, the government is talking about trying to make sure that there is a UK economic recovery. And for me, a complication here is you can't get very far in battery technology without involving the Chinese. And if you need hydrogen, currently, you have to bring it in a tanker from Rotterdam. Yeah. So there is a bit of a conflict, isn't there, between stimulating the UK economy and making great progress. Do you see that?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's so many factors at play at the moment. Some of them are positive and some of them are negative. I mean, a lot of the news around Brexit, I mean, I don't know if you've seen this morning, Boris Johnson has said, prepare for no deal. The optimistic of us have been hoping that there was something will come together, but that's a pretty bold statement. And clearly that's going to influence both exports of vehicles from the UK, which is obviously a significant factor in the economy, but also the imports of products that we use to build cars. There was the recent issue around importing components from outside the EU and trying to get them accepted as UK products, so therefore they would get a lower taxation when you sell them into the EU. The EU's rejected that. And there was a specific request just for electric vehicles, which they've also rejected. So what that's doing is potentially creating a marketplace where we're seeing UK demand increase. We're seeing subsidies there to help people to move to electric vehicles, and people seem to want to. But actually, you know, what, as you say, how can we make the most of that in the UK and use what we're basically going to be given in terms of the situation with Brexit and so on, that to build the UK's capability up in the short term with battery electric and hybrid vehicles, but yeah, as you say, longer term, the opportunity to do more with hydrogen as well. So I think the opportunity is there, and we've seen things like BritVolt, you know, British Volt, and their plans to start building batteries in the UK. And obviously, if there are tariffs between us and Europe, that's going to potentially make that more beneficial as well. It's difficult to predict at the moment. I think the overall biggest concern is, what about the tariffs shipping to the UK and how that's going to affect the overall UK automotive market? And that's everyone's, you know, I guess, biggest concern right now.
No, I'm sure that's right. I guess also just to explore with you, a lot of people are going to be out of work on the downside of this pandemic. It's not much fun, I don't think, at the moment to be a student, because the opportunities going forward will be difficult. But it does seem that this move to zero emission of any sort, whether it's hydrogen or electric or anything else, probably creates quite a lot of opportunities for better quality type jobs. And as you know, I'm particularly interested in making sure that those jobs are not only available to young people, but also to those people who perhaps by gender or background aren't typically in the engineering type world. So
yes.
do you see some good quality opportunities for young people?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I do see that there, you know, that things are being done right from primary school age upwards now to really try to excite young people about engineering STEM activities in schools, although obviously more difficult to do at the moment, but and generally, you know, educating people about the opportunities around engineering. And it's, you know, it always suffers from a bit of a, it's not always seen as the most exciting thing to do, unfortunately, but you know, it is critical to get people the right ideas. Unfortunately, unless you follow that path of studying from GCSE level, studying into, you know, the right maths and sciences and things, it becomes you're not necessarily going down the right path. But yeah, I mean, I think what we are seeing is people coming out of university now with specific degrees that give them a really strong understanding of the technology. And, you know, at MIRA, we have our MIRA Technology Institute that's providing courses from everyone from trainees through to graduates and postgraduates, to particularly around electrification and autonomy and cybersecurity and things like that. So again, helping to give people the right knowledge and capability to work in these, you know, the kind of developing areas of the industry going forwards.
Well, I hope so, because the UK became strong in the past by being fabulous at engineering in all respects, civil engineering, railway engineering, yeah, highway engineering and so on. And in particular now, there just is so much new technology. So I mean, these are not just great jobs. I mean, they're really interesting jobs for young people. So I really hope we can make something out of that. I think that would be really very good. And so lastly then, Greg, just to say, you've already explored this a bit. There is this question about what we need government to do. So far, I'm hearing lots and lots of warm words out of governments. They've naturally been focused on the pandemic itself, but also quite a bit of good rhetoric, at least, about how the road to net zero and the restarting of the economy are inextricably linked. So if the government were listening to this, between us, what would we want the government to do?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, Leon, I think that there's been a great, this has been this positive message that, you know, in terms of post-COVID-19 recovery, the government, you know, has been looking to fund companies to develop particularly technologies that will support the road to zero. So I think that's really positive. And I think, you know, there needs to be clarity. There's talk about moving back the passenger vehicle, petrol and diesel, and bringing that earlier. And we actually did a little survey with SMMT, some of the SMMT local members earlier this week on a webinar, and said, you know, is that, you know, do you see that? Is that going to be good for your business or not? And overwhelmingly, I think it was something like 50% were positive, 10% negative, and the rest said it would be, you know, it would be neutral, but that's still neutral or positive is still good. It was good to see that people were to embrace that and say, actually, you know, we're gonna move this forward. I mean, there's a big question over the bus industry at the moment. The overall funding model with the, you know, with the impacts of COVID-19, you know, how is that going to move forwards? That's a big question. And as I mentioned before, providing sort of sustainable funding for buses and actually including a retrofit in there as well, as a shown as a more sustainable and some way preferable approach, because, you know, it's saving resources, it's saving cost, and it's not simply moving diesel buses around to pollute elsewhere. So I think those are a few things. I mean, I think, yeah, generally, I think the government's doing a lot of positive things with infrastructure and vehicles. As I said, in public transport, there's still some questions that need to be answered, I think, to support sustainable growth of that industry and allow bus operators to, you know, to be able to move into that technology.
So Greg, look, this has been really great. We've already had our half hour lunch break today, so thanks very much indeed for joining me at Lunch with Leon. Lunch with Leon is an ITT Hub production. Please go across to our website at itthub.net. You'll see details, not only just our news channel, but also this and other podcasts as to how to subscribe. But I've had great fun today talking to my friend Greg Harris, who is the Global Electrification Services Leader at Hariba MIRA. he's right at the front end of the latest developments in terms of what's going on the road to net zero. I really enjoyed having Greg on the show. And Greg, look forward to having a real lunch with you as soon as we're allowed to. Thanks very much indeed.
Thanks, Leon. I really enjoyed that. Thank you very much. Bye.